the Boom.
Boom.
Athletics High Performance Podcast. Providing you with the performance training, college scholarships, coaching education, and elite athletic development. Now, your host, Seth Boomsma.
What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. Your host, Seth Boomsma here. Man, today is a good one. I think you guys are going to love this. I know we've had a lot of good guests on our podcast, but this one is by far my favorite. And perhaps that's just because of how much this guy has meant to me and not only my athletic career, but also my coaching career. It's Alan Bartsch Jr. This is one of the best and most hard-hitting podcasts we've ever done. Alan has done so much for me as not only an athlete or a coach, but as a person as well. Alan is based around the Sioux Falls, South Dakota area. He was my coach growing up, my trainer. He was like my big brother, my best friend. He helped me through a lot in my athletic career and helped me kind of develop where we are today with Boom Athletics. Alan, we dive into his athletic career. He's one of the best athletes I've ever known. Insane sprinter, insanely high vertical, a 50-inch vertical, guys, and also an insane lifter as well. Then we touch on his personal training career as well and his coaching and how he's transitioned that into being a stay-at-home dad now and, you know, building a family with 7 kids. And I think it's amazing that you guys will see Alan's mindset and how he relates it to everything with athletics. I think that's really cool. And one of the things he really talks about is how what you do in one thing, there's like a big transfer over to another thing and how you approach that. But without further ado, let's get into this podcast because you guys are really going to enjoy it. I appreciate Alan taking the time out of his busy schedule to be on the podcast with us, and let's dive into it. Thanks, Alan, for being on the podcast today with me.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of people don't know who Alan Bartsch Jr. is as of recent years. You know, I know who Alan is, and I've known Alan for, geez, I don't even know how long it's been, 15 years maybe now?
I would say, I think you were 15.
Yeah, I was 15 or 16 when I first met you.
Okay.
So about 13 years. But why don't you give a background of who you are and, you know, what you're about?
Okay. Athletically?
A little bit of both.
Okay. So as an athlete, I was a sprinter. I worked on vertical jump. I did strength stuff. I did grip stuff. And that's about it, I think. And then as far as where you and I, where our paths met, I think you were 15. So how old are you now?
29.
So half your life ago, which is weird because I have a 14-year-old daughter now who's almost 15. So that's odd. I found this skinny 15-year-old cross country kid who wanted to sprint, and he said, "Can I sprint?" I said, "Sure." And I trained primarily athletes up until, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I think, something like that. And then I kind of retired to stay home with my kids.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot we can touch on within that quick background.
Yeah, I kind of go over some stuff.
First, I want to just touch on how we know each other. So from my story, I was kind of like the nerd in school where in study hall and classes, instead of paying attention, I'm sitting there reading forum boards and everything back when those existed. And how I met Alan actually was through a forum board called EliteTrack.com. And I remember I posted on there something about online training. Can I look for this and whatnot? And I remember Alan ended up private messaging me and saying, "Hey, I'm in Sioux Falls. This is my background. Here's a quick bio, blah, blah, blah." And so I go to my parents. I'm like, "Hey, there's this guy in Sioux Falls, you know, like he's insanely athletic himself. He trains a lot of these athletes. Do you think I could go train with him?" And at the time I'm running cross country, but I wanted to be a sprinter. But me reading training knowledge that was kind of out there at the time was, "Hey, cross country is going to help your 400, you know, all this stuff, build a base, whatnot." And when I first met Alan, boy, did my entire view change on training. And like, not only did my viewpoint on training change, like I developed a really, really close friendship and really kind of a brotherhood with Alan that really transformed into the whole of my athletic career. And we became so close throughout that point. And I remember our first session, you know, I go in there and just like Alan said, like, hey, I'm a skinny cross country kid. I want to run fast. And he's like, okay, this is kind of what you need to do. Get out of cross country, take these steps. I'm going to write a plan for you. Let's go after it. And the rest is kind of history, but that's kind of how we know each other. But Alan is so multidimensional in terms of he was the best performance coach. I know we had Logan Koopman on a few episodes ago, and one thing he talked about was Alan was performance coach 1.0, and now Seth is performance coach 2.0. And I think he kind of hit that right on the head, because a lot of my philosophies, I would say 95% of the stuff that we work with on our athletes is taken from Alan. So I owe this guy the utmost credit for what we have built here at Boom Athletics. It's largely coming from how Alan shaped me and developed me into not only an athlete, not only a coach, but also a young man as well. So I got to thank you for that, because you have helped me a ton, and I can't thank you enough, and I'll continue to thank you for the rest of my life. So,
well, thank you. That's wow. I do know that one thing that I think is very important is that when you have athletes, you don't know who's going to be that 1 out of 100 that's going to work, or the 1 out of 1,000 or whatever. I know that I have a very obsessive personality. So I'm the kind of guy where, you know, all through college, I am staring out the window thinking about how I can run a little faster, or I'm laying in bed at night staring at the ceiling thinking, maybe tomorrow I'll try this and that. What if I change my block setting, you know, 5 degrees? And so you hope that you find those athletes, but you know that that's going to be a small percentage. Mm-hmm. But you still have to assume every person you get could be that person. Mm-hmm. Because if it's not, fine. But if it is that person and you don't do everything for that person, you know, you'll never know, and you'll never find that person. So, and I can name maybe 5 people that were like super, super, super dedicated that would do, you know, anything I would tell them. And you're absolutely that guy. And I had to assume that you were that guy. And you know, because so many times someone will come to you and they'll say, I'll do anything you want me to do. And those are the guys who will do nothing. Those are the guys who drop off fast. The guys who will text me and say, I want to work out 6 days a week and I want to come there 4 hours a day. Those are the guys I get worried about. With yourself, I knew you were all in. I knew that even at 15 or 16, you came to me by yourself. Your parents didn't send you. You contacted me all on your own. You told me your goals. You had a very dedicated mindset. You had specific goals, and people just say, I want to be the best. You know, that's, you said, I want to sprint. Can I be a sprinter? Yes, you can be a sprinter. At what level? Let's find out, you know, let's see. But everyone can get faster no matter what. And I always feel that no matter how good you are, regardless of your age, you can always improve. If you're the best in the world, you can still get a little better. And I think another thing is you have to learn, you can learn from anybody. I mean, I learned things from kids I trained that were way slower than me that I picked things up on. You were never afraid to ask for help. You never wanted to be right. You were okay being wrong. If what you asked me and I said, that doesn't make sense. And you'd always say, well, why? And I always said, if I can't tell you why, then why are you doing it? You know, so I should be able to explain why we're doing it. And you never had a problem asking me. You never had a problem texting me. I love when guys would text me, because when you think about it, who are the people that are texting you, asking you workout minutia at you know, 9 o'clock at night? It's the people that care. You know, it's the ones that don't text, but I'm like, does he really care? So no, training you was huge for me, because what I told you was I had to figure out the sprint game on my own. Mm-hmm. And I was not fast naturally, I would say, or maybe I was, but then I didn't do sprinting for years. And I'm in college as a 21-year-old, just doing bodybuilding training, and I've lost all mobility. I don't know the sprint game at all. I had shin splints, like I said, chronically for a good 3 years. I still feel it to this day. But I didn't know where to start. I would ask a lot of people different questions and got various information. I didn't have as much guidance. So I thought, if I can have you learn what took me, let's say, 8 years, if you can learn that in a year, that'd be great. And I think you learned it in like 6 months. And I was amazed by that, because you were willing to just take whatever I told you and apply it. And then 2 days would go by through our next session and it'd be fixed. And I think that's crucial. So I think that's another thing with coaching, is you want to pass on what you know to somebody else. And you also want to help people just for no other reason than just to help them out, because I feel that's a good thing to do. And you made it really easy for those things. I think sometimes coaches get too much credit. I mean, you know, I remember training you and another kid who was older, who's, I don't know if you can name drop or not. Taylor Olson, who was an awesome guy. He was a state champ, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong in the info. I mean, he was great about bringing you along, and I remember telling you guys, if you guys ran a certain time, I'd get you guys a shirt. I remember you ran that time and you texted me about it. I said, I got one for you. I remember that vividly. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, yeah, I remember seeing kind of a younger version of myself, but I thought in my mind, I could help you out in ways that maybe I didn't have that. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, like I said, cut down time. Because being an athlete, when you're in it, it seems like you have forever. But really, mm-hmm. 10 years is a long time. If you get 10 years, that's a long time. So if you can shave some of that time off to kind of fine tune yourself, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah. And I think you said it right there. A lot of the relationship that you and I had is similar relationships in like training groups that I see the athletes that I work with nowadays. You just bring up Taylor and I training together, and then obviously, you know, Koopman and Mater down the road and stuff like that when we were together. And it's like we saw a lot of that and how we looked up to you, and now all of a sudden I see all these athletes now kind of like looking up to me, and I'm like, dang, this is the exact same as what I had with yeah. Alan. And that's super cool to see, and how you can develop those relationships and build that trust with them. You know, like we've had Doug Roby on the podcast, we've had Logan Koopman.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've kind of had that whole group back there at the old Wellness Center days that kind of saw everything. So those two guys know who you are. Mm-hmm. But our audience probably doesn't know fully who you are, you know, as an athlete, we kind of just touched on your coaching. Who were you as an athlete? I know we can touch on a variety of vertical jump and sprint topics, yeah. and also weightlifting as well.
Okay. I don't know how far back you want to go, but like I've always had that obsessive personality where I have very clear-cut goals, and this is what I still do to this day, and with my kids too. What are your goals, and then how do we achieve them, and then all these little micro goals on the way there, and of course whatever plan you have, once you have the plan established, you know it's going to change many, many times. That's just going to happen. But I always had these very distinctive goals that I couldn't get out of my mind. So when I was maybe 16, 17, I wanted to dunk. I could jump pretty good for most people. But I mean, I remember writing down diagrams on my notes of just like a scale version of me and how high I would need to jump, what I thought to dunk, and where I thought it was at that point. And that was my focus for a long time. I played basketball for a couple of years. I wanted to play college, but it just, when it came down to it, I didn't want to go to a tiny school and hate it. And I didn't have much experience mm-hmm. to play, so I didn't. And then I got into just weightlifting just to be big and strong. And that's what I did up until I was maybe, a junior in college maybe. And a good friend of mine in the dorms who was a good high school runner said, you know, I'm going to do track next year. You should do it with me. And I said, college track? I have no clue what I'm doing. I don't think I'm fast. I don't think anything. But I said, okay. I said, you have my word. I will absolutely do it if you're absolutely in. And he said, yeah, I am. So that summer I did a crash course on track. I cringed at the workouts I did. I mean, like I remember the first thing I did was he had us do, it was a YMCA group with kids that were like 8, 9, 10. And here I am, you know, a college guy. And he has to do a 400 meter dash, just all out sprint with 1 minute break and repeat. So no big deal. You know, just one lap around the track. And I remember at about 80 meters, I knew I was done. That was it. So that was, but I still stuck with it. I did puke. I came back the next time. I came back to college ready to go. And my friend bailed. But I said, I'm already going to do this. So yeah, I sprinted. I was slow. I had crazy shin splints. It took me a few years to even get rolling at all. But again, I had a goal. I needed to run a certain time. And I knew that at least my potential was greater than what I was showing. I guess it wasn't necessarily how fast could I run. It was just, I knew I could do more. And it's tough because you have people that are educated track coaches that are, you know, high level telling me that I don't think you quite have it. And, you know, you want to trust these people, and they're not trying to do it to be mean. They're trying to be helpful. But I just didn't think that they were right. Mm-hmm. I truly thought I could be faster. And I had a bunch of reasons why I thought that. And I do think that most people's potential is much greater than what they think it is, but people aren't willing to stick it out long enough. Mm-hmm. You know, the average person can probably improve a lot more than they think, but who in the right mind is going to stick out track for 10 years and not be good? Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't really make sense. But that's what I did. It took a long time. And I'd say right as I really got fast, I had some injuries kind of creep up. I couldn't run in spikes for my last couple of years, which is a big deal. So I never quite ran the official times that I wanted to, but meanwhile through that I was still training vertical jump just because it kind of correlated with my sprinting. And that I had, I did a 50-inch standing vertical, and a 54 and a half, I think, running. And that was a peak. That was like, you know, I'd have people ask me 6 months later, you know, hey, can you jump for me real quick? You know, and I'd be in dress shoes or something like that. I said, no, I got to warm up or something. But yeah. So I did it 50, which is my head on the rim. That was a big focus. I tried hitting a 12-foot broad jump. I didn't do it. I did 11.8 maybe. My lifting, I did 740 squat when I was 23. And I knew that I could do more, but I knew the problem was the diminishing returns of squatting that much. Mm-hmm. It took so much out of me to do that. And I was also doing sprint workouts and all the plyos and then doing the heavy Olympic lifts, which I really liked that. So I built my own platform for that to try to hit, you know, 400 clean, which I did. But yeah, it was hard to do that stuff. So then after that, my squat, I kind of kept it maintained. I tried to work on kind of rate of force development, moving, let's say 600 pounds as fast as I could or 500 pounds as fast as I could. Then I transitioned off of that. Well, once I started to get a little bit injured, just small stuff, but I never wanted to have that big injury where I have to stop. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have it. Then I did have back surgery though, which, you know, apparently is unrelated, but I don't see how it wouldn't be, but it was just a pinched nerve in a degenerative disc. So I had my spine fused, mm-hmm. L4, L5 and S1. So yeah, I mean, I wasn't supposed to do anything after that. So then I was doing gripping. So grip's a whole different world. That's a whole different kind of thing. And I tried to work on that to try to establish a certain, I guess, record. There's a way to get certified to do this. So I put that on hold. I changed my diet around so I wouldn't gain weight because I wasn't able to even walk for a while. And then, yeah, about a year or two later, then I hit, I guess, world-class grip is what they say. But yeah, I did that and here I am.
Yeah. So I think what's really cool about everything you just touched on is how you were world class in multiple different avenues. I want to start with sprinting since that was kind of the first thing. Obviously vertical jump was probably the first thing from high school, but sprinting was kind of what really took off and developed probably the most in that time. Where did that influence come from? Like, where did you find some of your training philosophy? How did you develop that? Did you take a lot from vertical and weightlifting and just plug it more in the sprint area? Because I know you said the first couple of workouts you did were you'd cringe at the workouts you did.
Yeah, I mean it's hard because college track is one of those sports. It's tough to coach. You have one coach for 50 kids. It's a terrible ratio, and they have to cater to the masses. They can't just have individual workouts. And then you have some walk-on guy who's never run before. You know, no one's going to do you any favors. And I don't blame them. You know, they have limited resources, and so I understand that. But still, that's still your primary resource. So when you're doing workouts that don't really fit you, I mean, I was a heavier guy. I was probably 205 then, and that's just hard. My speed endurance was always awful. And so a lot of these workouts, I'm just always recovering, I felt like, from the previous workouts. I was never just fresh. Where I got my inspiration from, just a few online things. I had a good friend also who's coaching who helped me a lot. And then I started just applying common sense, things that worked mm-hmm. in other things, not even workout stuff, but just things that just make sense. Like, you know, why would I want to sprint and work on speed development if I'm even close to fatigued at all? If I'm less than 100%, you know, why would I do, if these warm-ups that they're having me do, running 800 meters and doing all this stuff, why would I do that if it's going to tire me out for what I really need to do? I need to run faster. That's it. If I can't run faster in my workout, then it's not helping me at all, is what I mm-hmm. thought. And that it applied, it worked. And I was willing to try almost any method under the sun. And I was willing to kind of see what did and didn't work and give it a fair chance. Because I desperately wanted to be faster. But as far as one source, it's kind of hard because it's kind of like you take a bunch from a lot of different places and then put it all together and see what works. I would say I have a million sources and I feel like I'm leaving them out if I name any, but mm-hmm. but not one that just jumps out at me. I just realized later on, like, wow, what I did in college didn't do me any favors for sure. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I don't blame anyone for that. But you know, it's on me to get better. I need to find ways to get better, and no one's going to do that for you. You have to find that out for yourself. So I had to do all the research I could. Online forums helped me a lot. And I would email anyone who was a sprint expert, anyone, and send them in my form or ask them questions. And if you send out 100 of them, you might get a reply back from five. And I would just try to apply that and see, and I'd watch countless videos, but at the end of the day, it's what works for me. And I realized that a lot of things for me, I was an outlier in the sense that I was heavier than most sprinters. I had less experience. I had terrible speed endurance. My mechanics were really, really bad. I had poor flexibility and mobility, and I'd run really, really tight, especially in a meet. So I thought, mm-hmm. how can I fix all those things? And what I always do is just, let's start with the most fixable flaw. And let's just fix that, and we'll cross it off the list. And I keep working my way up. I'd also have a list of the things that will help me the most. So maybe the thing that helps me the most might take the longest to fix. So I have to kind of weigh which one I'm going to go after, but just one thing. And I think the biggest thing that really clicked for me after all that time, after years and years, was just my friend telling me to stop thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, because certain people think, and sprinting isn't really, I mean, you're running in a straight line. I mean, how hard can it be? And so I had to almost adapt that mentality. Now, it's obviously very complex, but I made it way too complex. And so I just shut my brain off and just ran. I trained with a few guys that were really, really fast, but just one-on-one with me. And that helped me a ton too. Mm-hmm. I saw what they did. We kept the workouts what we wanted to do and not what a coach is prescribing. We weren't doing 400s. I wasn't doing 200s. I didn't want to do 200s. I didn't want to do 100. I wanted to sprint short dash and just... that's what I felt like I was made to do, or at least built to do. So I guess it was always evolving. And even to this day, I still think of things like, oh, if I would have tried that, or I wonder if that would work. And I have my kids that I can work on with now when they want to try to do it. And that's kind of fun, but I'll still run with them. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, even though I'm way slower, I feel like I'm smoother. I'm still thinking about things to change as if I'm still competing. So it's kind of funny. So it never stops.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I want to kind of touch on some of your sprint numbers. You mentioned the 50-inch vert, which we'll get to here pretty soon.
Sure.
But what was your best 30-meter, 60, and 100?
Okay. So official times, not good for, I want to say 11-something for the 100. Basically what happened for me was when I was really peaking, I was already 28, 29 maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, I had... 3 kids at that point. So traveling wasn't really an option because my wife's working and I'm with them. So I thought, what can I do to just show me that I'm running a certain time? So I got those speed trap timers, the laser timings, you know, so none of these are official times other than that's as official as I can get. Because to me, that's the next best thing. If I can't travel, I just couldn't give up a weekend to travel somewhere and bring my 3 daughters with me, who are, you know, 3, 2, and 1 at the time.
Yeah.
So that was my next thing. So I won't claim those as official times at all. But I did do, well, I did a 3:07:30 when I was slower with spikes on, 3:07-something. But then when I was at my peak, I did it with shoes on in the gym with a wall like 10 meters off, so you have to slow down. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that would be my fastest point. I know that I had split times that actually Doug Roby was there. His son, they would time these times. So I had a couple 60s that were like, I did a 6:04 something. That's without reaction time. Mm-hmm. So that puts it in 6:05 or 6:06 range, I suppose. But I had that quite a few times. I mean, I had 20 of those probably. 30 meters. Yeah, 30 meters is the one I did the most probably. I don't think I ever got 3:06. I wish I refreshed these numbers here. I know I did a 10:04:100 at Roosevelt Track. Mm-hmm. I did a 10:01:01, I think, and I slowed up early, but that's just what it is. And again, these aren't official. These are just on a laser time. I don't want to confuse anyone with that. I did a flying 10, I think 0.87, but that was with shoes on.
Yeah. I was there for that one.
Okay, you were there for that. That was just shoes. So I think that at that point in my peak sprinting, what I did was I really got a lot of the weighted sprints, which I was kind of against that for a while, but I went very light with it and that helped me so much, but that also is what hurt my Achilles. And that's also what ended my sprint career. Mm-hmm. So when I came from, cause I would want to sprint year round. I thought I need to work on this stuff all the time. Like my mechanics are what I need to work on more than anything. So I need to work on that year round and that's probably hurt me too. So I would try to change it up, get away from the track. And so it was my off season stuff. I would just go on the grass and it converted really well for me when I went back on the track. So, I mean, I got my times pulling weights like close to where they were without when I started. Mm-hmm. So that helped me a ton. And I think that was my absolute peak. But again, I was just in shoes for a lot of those. The hundreds, I was in spikes. But all the other ones were in shoes. So it's one of those things I never know. And even now that Achilles still, if I run up a hill or something like that, I can still, it might come back a little bit. So mm-hmm. I never quite got it diagnosed. But I was always fearful of having like an Achilles rupture or something serious like that. So I just gave up the spikes. And then I thought, okay, I've done what I need to do. Sprinting's great. Let's maybe move on to something else. That's kind of what I did until I, you know, that way I didn't have to move on.
Yeah. And I just want to say this too, because I know I can attest to this and our athletes now can attest to this. We have the same timing gates that Alan always used. And typically what we've found is what you do in training often is what you do in meets. So yes, Alan didn't run 10:04 in an actual right. meet. However, it would have been pretty dang close when you include seven other competitors next to you, the arena full and stuff like that. So because I've seen Alan run, I saw the 0.87. I think I saw a high 11-foot broad jump that same day. I remember seeing a low 6.560 on a with shoes on and. It like just got done raining. I'm pretty sure the track was just soaked.
It's funny that you remember that better than I do. Yeah. I kind of forgot that until you just said it.
I mean, I remember a lot of the stuff seeing that he did. And I remember, you know, seeing some tens in the gym. I remember one time I was sitting in high school. I remember it was the first time I went like 1:69 10 meter from 3-point. I kind of did like a little bit of a rollover at the time. And then you sent me a text and I remember you went like 1:66 or 1:67. The next day, and I remember seeing that, and I was like, oh, I need to catch this guy.
Yeah, there's only so much you can improve on those yeah. starts. And, you know, at that point, too, it was hard because, you know, you're unattached, and there was mm-hmm. no facility. So an indoor track, it's cold here. It's not the summer. So I would either have to sneak into one of the colleges to run there, and they were cool with me doing it, but on any given night, you'd go there, and there'd be a basketball game, so you couldn't do it. So I had to work out on the gym floor, or I'd have to just go to the Roosevelt and shovel the track, you know? Mm-hmm. So I did that a lot of times, and my warm-up was just shoveling out a lane, but it, you know, to shovel 30 meters takes actually a lot of effort, more than it yeah. sounds anyway.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you got all the ice and all that stuff. So that was terrible. Plus you're running and sometimes it's -5 out there and you're running out there. So I'd be fully clothed up with layers. I mean, how fast am I really actually running? I mean, I'm running yeah. as fast as I can at the time, but I'm guessing not near what I need for speed development. So that definitely hurt me. But at the end of the day, the goals get faster and your goals don't care about excuses. They don't care about if it's cold out. Your goals don't care if it was hard to get to a track. You just want to run fast. Mm-hmm. And so no one wants to hear the sob story. You just got to get it done. And that's always been my mentality is what is your goal? How to get there? And honestly, self-assessment is probably one of the traits that I think I have the best is that, you know, I give myself credit. There's nothing wrong with being proud of your achievements. I think that I'm really proud of them and I understand mm-hmm. what good is and what great is and all that. But I also see the bad things I do or the things that I'm not good at, things I need to improve on. You know, I'm critical of myself, but I'm also willing to give myself credit for things. And I think that kind of honesty helps me assess where to go next. And mm-hmm. I tell that with my kids too. You know, they'll ask me something and I'll tell them the honest answer. But I'll say, this is why and this is how we should fix it. And then it all makes sense. And I've applied that to other things. I mean, now that I have kids that are in different sports, ones that I never did or even was remotely interested in, like I have a daughter in cheerleading. Well, okay, I've learned a lot about cheer now and I've applied the same exact stuff that I've done for vertical jump and sprint and grip into cheer jumps. And mm-hmm. it's worked, you know, mm-hmm. it's worked the same and she thinks I'm a genius and really I'm just kind of figuring out as I go and I'm watching some stuff. But the same basic stuff I think applies to almost 80% of it is just the same stuff, just using common sense and what works, having goals, having a proper progression. You know, she's working on three jumps in a row. Well, let's perfect one jump first. Let's make sure that's good. And I remember her, so in cheer you have, and I don't want to bore your listeners here, but they have a jump, it's a toe touch, your legs go out to the side. Mm-hmm. So having your vertical jump helps a lot. Having good flexibility helps a lot. But her jumps weren't good and she had both of those. So I said, are you sure it's your flexibility? Well, we tested on a trampoline and lo and behold, her legs went way up to the side, plenty of height. So she has flexibility and she has the jumping power. Mm-hmm. But it was just the speed and the snappiness of the movement. So we fixed that and it worked. And it reminded me of the sprint days because I still applied that and it worked. And she went from bad at the jumps to excellent. And I would say 2 months. I mean, I have video of her progression each time. And so I can look at them now and see how much better she got. And that's worked in other stuff too. So it works. But you have to be honest with yourself, no matter how hard it is.
Mm-hmm. So a nice little segue here to your vertical jump. You were a 2 foot jumper, and I mean,
yes,
it was pretty incredible to see you jump. I never saw you at your peak when you hit like your 50 inch and stuff like that. But I saw a variety of jumps. I remember you would kind of hop in every once in a while in one of my workouts and stuff like that and just do stuff. What was the sensation like for you hitting that 50?
It was big. So when I first got into really all in is when I realized what some of the best guys were doing in the world. And I thought, I'm not that far off. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really training for it specifically right now. But what if I do? So when I first started just training and I would just do max height jumps with full recovery, and I got like an instant 3 inches out of that just because I haven't been doing it for a while. And the sensation of hitting 50 was great because I think before that, maybe I hit 48 and a half. But I did kind of do like a taper for this, just like I would for track, where I had like a couple weeks, a 10-day kind of deal where I backed off training and lowered the volume down, and I hit 50, which was obviously a goal because it's a clean number. I still think I could have done more off the run though. I mean, I was only 4.5 higher off the run. My approach wasn't the best for sure. I mean, I still kind of did like a jump stop on both. Mm-hmm. On full run and even like a one-step one, I would just do like a little jump stop. So I feel like I still had more to give actually, but I'm the kind of guy where I have these goals and I hit them and I'm kind of good with it. And that's kind of what that was for me. It was like, well, the amount of work to jump 51 might not be worth it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just jumping high just to jump high. It was a super fun goal. And I did it purely for selfish reasons of just, it's a goal that I had for me that felt good and it felt great. Yeah, I was good with it. And then I'm like, okay, let's keep going on the sprinting. Cause that's, I guess sprinting was more of a challenge to me because I wasn't as naturally good at it. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot more things to overcome where jumping, I kind of always kept it in there. Even when I played basketball and stuff, I was always jumping a little bit. So it might be my best physical achievement, but maybe not my proudest. I think I'm probably more proud of just my sprint improvement. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a great sensation. It was fun. It was good to have everything kind of come together too. You know, you have a plan. So I was almost surprised that it went exactly as I planned, I guess.
What did you have to change or maybe even do more of in order to achieve the 50 inch?
Okay. So I was building up volume each week. And the higher you jump, usually, the more power output you have, the more rest you need. So you can take a little kid who's 10 and he could probably do 10 jumps in a row and the 10th one could still be his highest. Where when you're at you know, the mid 40s for jumping, I mean, if you can jump and then take 20 seconds and jump again at that same height, that's pretty good. So I would do a thing where I would do many sets of two jumps like that, where I'd do a jump and I'd walk back, take maybe 20, 30 seconds, jump again, and then take a few minutes. So we're looking at like an hour to get 20 jumps in. And quality, the same thing with sprinting. It's got to be quality or I feel like it was wasting my time. And I did a thing where when I started feeling my performance drop a little bit, like let's say for 3 jumps in a row, I would pull the plug in the workout. I would chart where that was. And then next week I'd do the same thing. What I did for when I hit 50 was I backed down to singles. So just one jump and I cut down on my lifting a little bit in the squats. And that was kind of enough to get me over the edge, I think. And still, I still feel like there's still more to give. And I know that sounds funny, but I just remember months later when I didn't do any jumping at all. And I went in there, I did 45 a bunch of times. I thought, did I really lose 5 inches? And then I slowed my arm swing down and I went like 48 and a half again. So just that extra jump, it was like, it was still there, but there's still things I could have changed. And I wonder if maybe I could have done that in my 50, could I have jumped even higher? I mean, this is one of those things when you're obsessed with something, you're always trying to find the best way. And you're always trying to second guess, like maybe there's a better way that could maybe pass that on to somebody else and maybe save them some headaches.
Yeah. So I know a lot of the basketball players and really athletes in general that we work with here are doing approach verticals, and you being a 2 foot jumper, but also working with 1 foot jumpers. What are the differences in how you coach their jump technique?
Yeah. I mean, the 2-leg guys are just a lot more strength oriented. And I always feel like when guys would start putting on weight, like if they're in another sport, like for football, I feel like they would transition to that 2-leg guy. But a lot of the single leg stuff is that elasticity, that triple jump, high jump kind of mentality, where I'd have them do a little bit more bounding. I would have them do, I guess, less weight training if that's their main thing. If their main goal is to jump high off one leg, I mean, I'm thinking of even high jumpers and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but 'cause that's mainly who it was. then I would, yeah, I would say that we need to identify how important the one leg jump actually is for them. If that's above all else, or if they're a basketball player and they want to do both. But for me, yeah, more, just more single leg stuff, more bouncy stuff, more, you know, high rate of power output, putting out a lot of power in a short amount of time, that elasticity. Where the two leg jump, it gives you a lot of room to have a slow ground contact, really get your arms in there. So the power and in moving weight quickly, I think transferred really well for me. Even if my max strength didn't go up for the two leg jumps, after I hit my 740, I knew I could probably get there in a few weeks or a few months of hard training for the squat. I kept it close enough. But me doing like the reactive squats where I drop down fast and go up fast reversal with, you know, with 500 pounds or so, that carried over to 2 foot jumps really well for me. Mm-hmm. I would do that stuff with single leg guys and it would help their standing too, but it wouldn't really affect their one leg. And for me, I think the big thing is just movement efficiency, getting used to them, getting that approach down, and then doing some of the bounding type stuff.
Mm-hmm. So the differences in how you would train for vertical jump versus sprinting, what are those differences and what are the similarities?
Okay. Well, the similarities, especially for what I was interested in, was the shorter stuff. Mm-hmm. was quality and full rest, full recovery. And maybe that's why my speed and endurance was bad, but it was always bad before that. And I guess I wasn't trying to be a 200 meter runner, so I never tried to fix it. But I can say that for sprinting, yeah, I wanted full recovery, and I would also try to chart my times using my timer to kind of see what worked and how much volume I could get in, and my work capacity increased greatly with both. So they were very similar in that regard. Mm-hmm. Where are they different? Well, with training wise, I feel like the sprint, you're obviously doing it longer. You know, even a short sprint, that's 2 or 3 seconds. It's still longer than a jump, and it would take a little bit more out of me. I need a longer rest. If I wanted to actually run a 60 or 100, I need to do some of the high speed type stuff, like top end type sprinting. And for jumps, there's not really an equivalent of that for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was depth jumps and things like that, but I never got much out of those for me personally. So, you know, again, the 80% rule, I think 80% is almost the same. I kind of applied the same stuff to both and found that it worked.
Yeah. Favorite exercise?
I can tell you the exercise that is the most telling if someone's an athlete to me. Out of any exercise was the overhead med ball throw. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily my favorite lift or exercise. I mean, I just love the good old fashioned squat. But I also love the chin up. That's one that I kind of fell in love with too, that and the pull up. And that helped me sprint actually, but more on that after maybe. I think that the overhead med ball throw was one thing that I found, regardless of someone's size. You and Koopman were great examples of guys who were powerful little guys that were 150 pounds, who would throw it further than the offensive lineman that is 300 pounds, who's benching 405 and squatting 600 pounds, but couldn't apply that in a fast way. I could easily tell who was an athlete by that. And I have some guys that are that big, that are the 300 pound guys that are hurling that thing, and I know that they are fast, regardless. No ifs, ands, or buts. So even more than a broad jump, even more than a vertical jump, the overhead med ball throw was something that I could definitely tell who was an athlete.
Yeah. So you just touched on chin up, pull up.
Yeah.
How does that influence your sprint training?
So for me, I remember reading this article saying that it helps your overall relative body strength, mm-hmm. because your body is kind of one organism. And so that helps somehow with the wiring in your body think that your body is lighter than it is. And that might be, you know, bro science kind of thing. But I'm like, well, I might as well try it and see. And there's some other stuff as far as it helping stabilize the spine. And I never bought into that much, but I did go heavy on the chin-ups and I did seem to get faster. Whether they're related or not, it could be coincidence. I've had other people try it. It seems like it works, but if nothing else, your relative body strength increases, and that's never a bad thing.
Yeah, I kind of found something similar. Obviously, I was obviously getting older during that time too, but also getting stronger. I remember, you know, doing weighted chins with 125 strapped to me or even bench press, you know, as high as 365. And each time my bench was super high, I was always running really, really fast. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of find this similar thing with bench press as well?
Yeah, for me, I had certain lifts that were always just the same. Like my incline and my power clean were always the same. Mm-hmm. My chin up, yeah, it's all, I mean, it's like when your body's ready to go, it's ready to go. And I think that's actually helped me in the vert when I backed off other stuff. And that's why, you know, peaking for performance works. But for the chin-up, for some reason, it seemed like it helped a lot. Another thing that helped me a lot was the static stretching of the hip flexors. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was just because I was extra tight, but that helped me go to another level. Just little things like that. But again, I'm a guy who's willing to try any little method I can read at least and see. So for everyone that works, there's 100 that don't, and some of them could just be coincidental.
Yeah. You just touched on the little things. I think this is probably one of my top five takeaways from you. And one of these days I just need to put out a post of my top five takeaways from Alan. But one of my big takeaways was doing the little things. And that's kind of what, for me, was like the no leaks in the bucket type philosophy. Like, if I know I'm doing this and they're not, that's just gonna make me that much better. Mm-hmm. So what were those little things that you kind of developed over time to help you have better performance?
Well, yeah, I mean, little things are just everything to me. I feel like when you do everything in your power to get better at something, and that's not just working hard all the time, it's working smart and also educating yourself to what smart is. I think that you earn an entitlement to succeed, and that's basically what confidence is. You feel entitled because you've worked harder than everyone else. So I'm willing to do everything. I'm willing to measure out my food every morning, every single day for the day. I still do it to this day. You know, I have 7 kids and I feed them all different stuff, and I still have to get my meal in because there's no excuses. I can't say, oh, I don't have time. I have 7 kids. I know I have 7 kids. So I need to plan around that. That's on me. Mm-hmm. So accountability is for sure a big thing. As far as, and diet, I mean, that's a huge thing. You're basically, that's a fuel that goes in your body. So to do everything else and then eat horribly, it just seems like you're not all in. Mm-hmm. I mean, so when people think they're all in, but that's not all in at all. That's a big takeaway for me. Other things are recovery. I mean, recovery is not a big thing, or it's not a small thing. It's a big thing, but people treat it like it's not a huge deal. But your recovery between workouts is huge. And that's what lacked for me in college, for sure. Doing all the recovery methods you can do. So I think those are it. And I think those little things add up so much. And just to give you a quick illustration of that, over the quarantine, I told all of my kids, I said, let's all pick one thing each day to do. We'll do it for 10 minutes, no more. You know, you're going to want to do it more than 10 minutes a lot of days, and some days you won't. But that way, 10 minutes is enough. We can do it every day. So each kid picked a thing. My one daughter did cheer jumps. A couple of them did pull-ups. They wanted to do a certain amount of pull-ups. For me, it was completely unrelated. It was braiding hair at a high level. I want to braid hair at a high level. I have 3 daughters. So 10 minutes a day, we did this every single day for, I would say, a good year. And the 10-minute-a-day thing, I'm convinced you can go from bad to, I would say, great, which to me would be like a 90 out of 100 on 10 minutes a day in a short time, if you're willing to do that at almost anything. Now, obviously you can go more hardcore if you want to, but, and that illustrates that just the smallest little changes over a prolonged period of time equals success, but it takes discipline. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. It's not supposed to be easy. It isn't, but you just have to do it. If that's what your goal is, you have to do it. So at the end of it all, yeah, I mean, all the kids are doing weighted pull-ups. And I have kids all the way down to, I guess my 1-year-old can't do a pull-up, but he tries to. But my 4-year-old can, my 7-year-old can, my 10-year-old can, my 11-year-old can, my 13, my 14-year-old can all do weighted pull-ups. And everything, but everything got better. We all picked random stuff. Some things were art-related, whatever. But the point is, the same things apply. Mm-hmm. So I think that illustrates that doing the little things help. But it also shows that any trait you want to get great at, it could be playing an instrument, whatever it is, something unrelated to anything you've done, you could get great at, and it sounds like an infomercial, on 10 minutes a day, though, mm-hmm. in a short period of time. And obviously, I chose 10 minutes because it's manageable. It's for kids who have short attention spans. I don't want to be punishment for them. But, you know, you can do an hour if you're an adult. You can do anything, any amount of time if you want to. But those would be my big takeaways, I think, is just the little things do matter. And what are those little things? It's everything. Mm-hmm. And they're not so little. And if you're willing to look for those little things, then obviously you've earned the right to get good, and you gain confidence. And I think as a coach, when I was coaching kids and with my own kids too, I think confidence is such a huge thing to instill in them, because every kid can get better. And not every kid knows that. And it might seem obvious to you, but it's important, because you need to point out all the things that someone can get better at and all the ways they can do that, and point out their strengths. Because I'd find myself, when I'm critiquing someone's technique, I can break it down pretty nitpicky, but I'm always careful of that, because I'll say, listen, these are the things to get better on, but I would also tell them all the things they did right, because otherwise it's a little demeaning and they feel bad. But I'd say every little bullet point of negative things you could fix means you can get that much better. Mm-hmm. So believing you can get better is huge. If you really think that you're limited, then you're going to be. And I know people try to fake confidence, but you have to really believe that you are good at something. You have to actually believe in with everything you have, you can get better because you can. But I think having someone else like yourself, what you do for your athletes is having them believe they can get good. Mm-hmm. And when you have someone who is in a respected position, believe in you, of course it's going to make you, and it has to be real belief. You know, it can't be a faked confidence in them. So when I tell my kids, hey, you're great. If you keep working on this, you could be this level or whatever. Really? I can? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I really believe that. And then when we go and prove it and do it, then they believe that. And I think that's huge. I mean, you have to find the good in people and what they can improve on and realize the potential maybe way higher in people than they would ever think. And it may take longer to get there than they think too. I don't know. But I think knowing you can get better is huge. So when someone hits a milestone of a 40-inch vertical, that's amazing, you know, but you could still go 42. And here's why. This, and this are wrong. Or someone hits a crazy lift or a sprint and you can find a couple of things wrong. I mean, when you were at your peak, we still found things we could fix.
Yeah.
I said, okay, listen, there's this, and this. And I think a big thing that I saw you do, and I actually used this to illustrate a point to my kids actually, was you were sprinting and you had three or four good friends that you sprinted with. They're all very, very fast too. They were close to you, but you were faster. But I said, listen, we need to get this stuff to actually matter in a meet, because I know for myself that sometimes what I would do in a meet would be totally different. And I said, we need to fix that and make sure you don't do that. So you're gonna run a certain way. It may be slower today. And everyone in the gym's watching because you guys are all the fast guys. And the other guys might think they're beating you. It doesn't matter because no one remembers who won the gym race, you know, compared to the actual race in the meet. And so, yeah, I mean, you lost a bunch in a row because you're trying something or it was close or you won a bunch. And of course, the first meet, you drop a crazy time.
Yeah.
So to have that kind of discipline and to look to the future and not be so short-sighted, not trying to win every single day. You know, winning that day was actually not. It was focusing on improving some technique against somebody, a technique that you mastered on your own, but not against an actual opponent that was close enough to you. And that catapulted you up even better. So that takes a certain kind of mind to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think what you said there about somebody believing in you from a respected position, that was you for me. Because I don't think I ever would have reached the level I ran at if I didn't have you believing in me. Because I can remember going home, especially like my senior year of high school when I really started like popping and dropping some fast times. I would go home and I'd tell my, you know, mom and dad, I'd be like, hey, you know, like I'm gonna run these times. I'm gonna run, you know, 6.9, I'm gonna run 10.6, so on and so forth. They're like, nah, I don't think you are. I'm like, no, Alan believes I can too. So it was kind of like you instilling that confidence in me is kind of what brought me over the top. Mm-hmm. And then basically gave me the swagger that I needed. Yeah. You know, it provided me with that sense of like confidence that I didn't have before, because coming from the background that I came from, I was never naturally good.
Yeah.
I had to kind of work to get to that level. You also touched on a little bit of like planning. So planning for training versus planning for now having seven kids. How is all that transformed into who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, so because currently I still have physical goals I'm trying to achieve. I'm not just you know, I'm trying to stay strong, trying to stay fit, but also I want to be able to still interact and play with my kids and all that kind of stuff. Planning, yeah, meal planning is huge. I spend a lot of time doing that each day, but I just have to do it. So I get up earlier each time, with each kid I'm up earlier each day planning my meals. I measure things out and I chart everything. I know that's more than most people are willing to do, but yeah, I plan that. My workouts are all over the place as far as when I get them. You know, I have a garage gym I can get into, which is less than ideal. I work out in the morning sometimes. If my wife is off, when the kids are napping, then I go and work out at a different gym. It's just whatever I can do. But so I have to just accept that's how it is and make the best of it. And yeah, it's fine. I mean, you know, the other thing is you have to be flexible with things. And I guess one thing we haven't really talked about is just overcoming failure, because, you know, all these plans we keep talking about is just, it seems like, oh, wow, it's a plan and it works. And it's so far from that even with your career, with all the highlights, there's so many times when you probably doubted yourself or you didn't run the time that you should have or thought you should have. And to overcome that, and over years and years and years, it takes a certain mentality that most just don't have. You know, you have to be resilient. You have to be almost almost crazy to keep, you know, failing and think that it's going to change and that you have the answer. But I think it's important for people to know that when they have goals, it's important to have some easy ones at first, some little ones to build confidence, to gain some momentum, and also be ready when things don't go well. Because it's easy. Training is easy when things are going great. Mm-hmm. Workouts are easy when you're hitting PRs, but at some point you won't. And the higher level you get, the harder it is to get those. Every little millisecond and centimeter become harder to get. So I think having the right mentality and being just absolutely bulletproof mentally are things that are overlooked. And that's something that all the best athletes have, that I think it's overlooked as far as all the physical gifts, yes, but just having that mentality where they can't be broken and really just all the little bumps and failures don't phase them. I think that's huge. And that's a big part of your career. Any long career that's successful has a ton of those fails, and you have to get over those. And let's be honest, you did great at it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So what was your biggest failure and how you overcame it?
I got a million of them. I mean, well, track would be a big failure for me. I mean, I literally ran, I want to say, for maybe 10 years. And I don't know the exact stopping point. It might even be more than that. And I would say I was fast for maybe two of them. So that means 8 years I had to be slow and work my butt off and kind of embarrass myself, honestly. I mean, you know, I actually get a little embarrassed thinking back on it. But it's just like I had to do it. I didn't care. I mean, so that was a big failure to me. And, you know, it hurt a little bit of time, but I'd never really wavered. I mean, I had times I thought, you know, is this worth it all to me? And I said, yeah, because if I do commit to something, I mean, I am for sure the all in. There's nothing that'll change my mind for better or worse. And yeah, so, but that was a fail. I mean, that's why my career went on so long. If I had ran those times that I wanted when I was 26, I probably would have been good to go. Yeah. I mean, I would have been like, all right, cool, you know? but I didn't. That's why I stayed with it so long. And yeah, it was kind of one big, I would say 85% of the time was a fail.
Yeah. When did you know that you wanted to be in the training realm, both as an athlete and as a coach?
Well, you know, I think some of the best coaches are athletes that didn't quite have it naturally and therefore had to acquire the information on their own. And I feel like I did that. And so I've always been a believer about kind of passing along to other people. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to make sure other people had the knowledge that I have. And in turn, they would pass it on to somebody else and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that I wanted to do something like that. I feel like I could help people that way. And that was my, I knew I was going to do that for sure. In the training world, of course, if when you're starting at a commercial gym, you don't get to just pick athletes. You have to work towards that. So I gradually kind of tailored things to that and had a few breakthroughs here or there. They got me training just athletes. And yeah, I mean, I think that was something I always knew I wanted to do, and I loved it. You know, I'm a huge guy about whatever you're passionate about, you have to just do it and do it all in. Mm-hmm. And that's everything that I'm in. And that's actually why I stopped doing it, because I had kids and I didn't want to miss them grow up. So I just went completely all in and just quit out of nowhere, because I knew I would never regret that. But getting into training for me was a huge part of my life, and it was a huge passion. And I learned so much as I did it. And I never stopped trying to acquire information from different sources. You talk about Doug Roby. He was a huge source for me, I think, because he also instilled confidence in me. But he's also a wealth of knowledge. You have someone who's older than you, who's done things at a high level. They absolutely have tons of wisdom to pass on. So I would always pick his brain and ask him stuff. And I know he'd ask me as well. But I learned a ton from him, and he's just a great example of that. But I think, yeah, passing on knowledge is huge for me, and just doing something that you love, and that's what training was for me.
Yeah, I love that. So when you were writing a program for an athlete, what was your favorite type of like training split or weekly setup that you liked?
Well, I always liked, so I got a lot of vertical jump guys, so I liked doing that because the strength always improves fast. So people love to see big numbers go up. I love programming like a 4-day split for them. I would sometimes go 3-day, even 2, but I think 4 days was good. And I'd kind of do like a heavy upper, and I'd do more of like an explosive lower body day if they were semi-advanced, you know. And if they weren't, I'd have them do kind of another heavier leg day, 2 leg days a week, 2 upper body days a week, different lifts, play around with the rep scheme a little bit. But more as they would get better. And again, this depends on the level of athlete, but as I got stronger, like where I got pretty strong there, where it wasn't really helping me anymore, except for just being stronger. And so I had to back off those things and put it more into like the rate of force development stuff, doing jump squats and things like that, which helped me a ton. So doing that, but I think a 4-day split works really good. And I loved programming that. And I loved seeing the results back from that. I always love seeing feedback from people because I was okay if someone didn't like the workout or thought it wasn't great, because I need to know why so I can then change it and fix it. And then I kind of put that in my database of what works and what doesn't, and basically cater things to more, because there's so many people that are just different. I mean, most people fall in a category, but I think of myself even too, with sprinting, and I was an outlier in a lot of things, that things that necessarily, and I realized that things that work for a lot of people maybe still don't work for me, but it doesn't mean I shouldn't use them on other people.
Right, right. So I love how you just said that, how everyone's different. How do you assess an athlete when they first come in?
Let's see, if I'm with them, I basically do a test out of things. And again, the med ball throw is a good one. I do a bunch of different tests, sprint stuff, jumps, some basic lifts. We do chin-ups. I'd see their mobility. I'd check a few things. I'd watch them sprint. That was a big thing, was just the slow motion sprint I could get a lot out of. But I would gauge how much horsepower they had, how much raw strength, and then kind of how elastic they were, how natural they were running, and kind of what kind of athlete they were. I could get a lot off that.
Yeah. So let's say an athlete is super elastic but not very powerful. How would you set up training for that type of athlete?
Okay. Assuming that he wants to be more powerful and he's not like a high jumper, and he wants to just be, let's say he's a basketball player or a football player, wants to be explosive and powerful, I would I'd still keep some single leg jumps in there, but I would mainly tailor it to two leg stuff. I would have him work on squats a lot. I did a lot of box squats with you. I would do that with him probably as long as his form is good. I wouldn't mess too much with the jump squats at first, and I would just get horsepower up with the most compound meat and potato type lifts, which would be like, you know, deadlift and straight leg deadlift. We would do squats, the pull-ups, you know, that kind of thing. Those would be the main things I'd work on. And then as his strength levels got to, you know, a certain level, let's say like a 2x body weight squat or something like that, then I would look at changing things even more and maybe make it a little more explosive. But he probably has a lot of that quick, you know, rate of force development. So he would need just strength at all costs is what I would go all in on.
Okay. I like that. So dealing with doubters, I know you mentioned earlier in the podcast about how college track coaches kind of doubted your ability. And then even as you became really good, people still doubted your ability. Yeah. How did you deal with that? And what is some advice you would give to a young athlete who's kind of like not at the level of their peers, but are trying to get to that level?
Yeah. I mean, I think people that want to tear you down just for the sake of tearing you down, they're always going to exist. I mean, no matter what you do, you could do a video of you donating money and people are still going to hate on it. So that just kind of shows you the mentality. So that stuff, you know, that never bothered me, because it can't, you know, that there's certain people that want to tear you down, and, you know, you can't let them have that. That's just their opinion, and that's okay. They're entitled to that. But at the end of the day, it doesn't affect what you do and what you've done. I think as far as people that are trying to be helpful and maybe misdiagnose your ability, like I think maybe some of my coaches did, you know, I don't hold it against them either. But how I would deal with it is, I think if you really believe something, you owe it to yourself to try to check it out for yourself. And, you know, yeah, I'm an extreme case who did it for a decade. That I'm not saying everyone has to do that. But if you think you can be good at basketball and you're not right now, figure out why you're not, what you need to do. And if someone tells you you don't have it and you think you do, show them otherwise. And, you know, I'm sure that person will be happy to say, hey, I was wrong. And if not, either way, you got better. So, yeah. I mean, if you have a crazy lofty goal and you fall short, you're still closer.
Yeah. So you and I worked together for a decade. I got to ask, what was your coolest moment of us working together, both coach and athlete relationship?
Oh, I got a million of them. I mean, because really you get to that point where like your personal best in training. I mean, I get pretty geeked up over what athletes that I'm training would do, like almost more excited than I would for myself, because sometimes I do something for myself and I would just say, okay, cool, I know I did it, and that's no big deal. But to see someone else, we have a kind of a goal together and do it. There's a breakthrough for you in high school where you were, you know, we were talking big, saying we're going to break 11 and that kind of thing. And you actually did it. That was huge, because you went from an also-ran who could be fast maybe to now the guy. I mean, you were now the guy. And then, of course, like, you know how track goes. You start chipping away that time. Okay, you've run, let's say, 10.9 or 10.8. We can still go faster. We found a million things to fix. We could go this time, or the weather was bad. There's always room to improve. I think you squatting a bunch of weight was exciting for me. It was a box squat, but I think you did 635 pretty smooth.
Yeah.
Let's see, you did 3 broad jumps. That was pretty big. That was fun to watch. Your sprint starts were always fun. But I think just seeing you hit walls, I think, in college, and us talking about it, and then you staying to it, like we said before, you have to have the mental toughness to stick through those times, and you having that, and then actually seeing you run those times later on, you know, it's a long time coming sometimes when that happens, but it's so worth it, and it's a feeling that very few get because most people won't stick with it long enough.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point you just made. I think one of my favorite memories, it's hard to pick one, like you said, but like when I transferred my second year of college and I ended up running 674.60 that year.
That's right. Yeah.
I remember that year before I kind of was bummed up with a hammy, dealing with transferring and all that stuff, running on attached, nobody really caring. And then all of a sudden going to a school that actually cared about me and valued who I am and stuff and end up running 674. I remember us texting back and forth. I'm in Ohio and how cool of a moment that was for us. Cause obviously the 6.94 senior year breaking the state record was really cool. Yeah. But I think that was kind of like super expected. Not saying that 6.74 wasn't expected, but it was like, for us, that was like a mass breakthrough. Because then all of a sudden we became a USA qualifier and it was like, hey, this kid's a 20-year-old kid and he's finally showing kind of what we've worked towards.
Yeah, I remember that was huge because 6.74 takes you to a whole different league.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 6.8 guy is a different league than a 6.7 guy. And yes, of course that guy can get there, but as is, that's a big difference. And it really moves you up the list in the country, in the world at that point. And it also kind of reinforces that you were probably more right than people thought you were with your training methods and that kind of thing. And that, you know, ego exists in every sport. You know, everyone wants to be right all the time. But I'm telling you, one of the best things that I learned is that it's okay to be wrong. And in fact, you want to find things out. And I think you were right in that situation. And to have a new coach and new group that let you do what you wanted to do was huge, I think. And they believed in you, and you believed in you, and you believed in me. And the crazy times happened. But if people knew how many block starts you did to get there, you know, you were meticulous. You were probably the most meticulous athlete I've had, actually. And I always said, don't be afraid to text me, you know. And and you weren't, you know, and that's great. I think that was awesome. But yeah, there's many good memories, and I'm sure as I'm driving home, I'll think of a bunch. But yeah running... Dropping down to the 6.7s, that's a huge jump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you just said it. The texting, I was always kind of like apprehensive to like text you because I was like, is he going to think I'm bugging him? Because I remember I was always like, geez, like he probably thinks I'm insane right now, like some of the questions I'm asking. But then now all of a sudden I'm in the position you were at, you know, 10 years ago. Now I'm in that position and athletes are texting me. I'm like, okay, I like it.
Yeah, like, no, I loved it because like I said earlier, it's like the guys texting you aren't the ones who don't care. In fact, these guys care so much that they're thinking about it after the workout when they're home and they're like, should I text him? And then they text me. That means they care. You know, and a lot of guys just put in what they have at the workout. And I think the second they leave, they forget about it and that works for them. But to get to the absolute elite, you have to put in more time. And that's what I was blown away with you is that between workouts, you know, I tell you some things to do. And, you know, a lot of guys don't do it or sort of do it, but I could always tell that you did it because it was like you made huge leaps and bounds between workouts. And that was such an added bonus for you. And you wasted absolutely zero time in your training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So closing in on the podcast, we touched on a lot of athletic feats, both for you as an athlete and as a coach. I think probably the most rewarding thing for you is being a husband and being a father of 7 kids. You want to touch on that a little bit? Just kind of like, what has that experience been like for you?
So yeah, for me, I had the realization when my daughter was born that, you know, when she goes to school, well, when you train athletes, that's after school. So when am I going to see her? So I thought, okay, I don't want to be that. At least for me, the best way for me to be a good dad is to be there. You know, I think as a parent, your kids just want you to be there. You know, when they're little, they want you to play on the floor with them. Learning how to do my daughter's hair was, they appreciated that because I cared. You know, learning how to do cheer jumps with a guy who knows nothing about cheer, I think they appreciate that thing. And so I just wanted to be there. I didn't want to miss stuff. I didn't want them to grow up and say, where is dad at? So I, like I said, I'm all or nothing. So I said, well, my wife has a good job. Let's just, I'm going to quit what I worked for. And a lot of people said, oh, you're wasting your potential And it's not what it was. I had a great time training and I love it and I still have that passion. But I think when you have the option to choose your family, you're never gonna regret that decision. And I haven't, and I've done it for years now. And, you know, and I have four boys are my youngest, and it's great. It's the same thing. I love a challenge. I love to put myself up against things. And I realized that later on, after all those things that we talked about that I did, the physical feats, a good friend of mine said, you know, I love that you always challenge yourself. And I realized that this was actually my new challenge. I didn't realize at the time, but I have a bunch of little ones, but you know, the family, learning things that I'm not necessarily good at, and trying to become great at those things, you know, even running a household is harder than it probably sounds. But I love it. I mean, I get up so early each morning. I get all the kids ready for school. After school, we do all kinds of fun stuff, and I try to have one-on-one time with all of them. And to me, it's the most rewarding thing there is, and nothing's even close. And for sure, it's absolutely my passion, and my wife has been my biggest supporter. She's encouraged me all along through all those physical feats we talked about. She was there, and I think she's impressed by them. But at the same time, she's kind of like, cool, you know, no big deal. And that's what I love, because she's obviously not with me because I have a high vertical jump or any of that stuff. She's just like, that's cool. But she always supported me in everything I did. And I think she did that with me staying home with the kids. I just, you know, she's like, if you want that, sure. So she's always been there. So I think you find people that are close to you and a real tight-knit group, and that should mean everything to you.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I appreciate you being on the podcast. Yeah. It was long awaited. Glad we could get you on. You're a mentor. You're an inspiration. You're one of my biggest idols.
Thank you.
At times, my big brother and best friend. I appreciate you, man.
Yeah, no problem, man. I always got your back, and I'll come back anytime you want. So
awesome. Thanks for so much.
Yep.